welcome to the Week Ahead in Russia, RFRL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies in London, and the author of several books, including We Need to Talk About Putin and The Weaponization of Everything. Mark, thanks again for joining me on this podcast on a monthly basis, and I'm very happy to welcome you today.
Hi there.
All right, great to have you. And as is now customary, we're doing this podcast on Twitter Spaces, and we're happy to take a few questions at the end. If you have a question, the best way to ask is by DM during the podcast. Now, once again this week, I want to start with a kind of disclaimer. I think it's worthwhile to talk about the war in Ukraine, but in some ways, there are really no words still to describe the enormity of it. You know, this is an unprovoked war that's killing many thousands of innocent people, essentially because of the whims of one man. Among the dead now are three generations of women killed by a Russian airstrike on Odessa on Saturday, the eve of Ukrainian and Russian Orthodox Easter. A woman and her three-month-old daughter, and also her mother, the child's grandmother, were killed. And at an Easter service several hours later at Russia's main cathedral in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin gave Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill an Easter egg, described by the state news agency RIA as a symbol of the triumph of life. So really no words for that. Now, Russia launched the new invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, so it's now in its third month. And one thing I'd like to discuss, and my guest and I last week touched on this, is a question that, or last time, is a question that before the invasion and in its early days seemed to have a simple no answer. But lately, more and more people seem to be saying the answer could be yes. The question is, can Ukraine win? And I guess a related question is, what would constitute a win for Ukraine? And another question is how this may affect Russia's thinking and Putin's thinking going forward. I saw that, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken mentioned on his visit to Ukraine last night, that he said that in terms of its war aims, Russia is failing and Ukraine is succeeding. So, Mark, apologies for the kind of three-in-one question, but I'm interested in your thoughts on these.
Okay, well, yes, indeed. It does very much depend on what victory means, which is a depressingly academic way of starting. Because we have to recognize that simply by not losing, in effect, Ukraine is winning, given the initial expansive nature of Putin's war aims. However, if winning means a full military victory, including driving the Russians out of Crimea, then I think that is, to be perfectly honest, much, much less plausible, at least in the foreseeable immediate sort of months and year time frame. And realistically, what's happening now? The Russians are adapting to the failure of the first stage of the war. They are now much more sort of relying on war as is fought by, prepared for, and trained by the military. Clearly, the first stage of the war was much more driven by Putin's and the spook's own notions about Ukraine and how it was going to just fall at the first push. We've seen the appointment of General Dvornikov as a single unitary military commander, which in and of itself is not necessarily a game-changing move, but it might be significant if it exactly suggests that there's going to be less political micromanagement and more a chance of letting the soldiers do their thing. Even so, there are very, very distinct limitations to what the Russians can meaningfully do. Dvornikov has got at the moment about maybe 80 battalion tactical groups, of which perhaps a quarter have been quite badly mauled and will need to be very, very heavily sort of replenished with men, equipment, and just simply given a chance to get their bearings again. About another 11 battalion tactical groups are occupied in dealing with the sort of the last defenders of Mariupol. And although we've had this suggestion by the acting head of the Southern Military District that in fact their aims also include taking Odessa and basically continuing their sort of land bridge, shall we say, all the way to Transnistria, essentially locking Ukraine away from the Black Sea, I honestly don't think that this is a plausible objective. I'm sure it's one that they would be delighted, but look, they've already had one go at Odessa and they failed. It's much more defended now. The Russians have lost a lot of their military capacity. And I think as much as anything else, this is mind games. This is an attempt to try and get the Ukrainians to essentially pivot some of their forces to defending against an attack that's not going to happen. But what it does speak to us is the degree to which actually the Russians are obviously going to be willing to change their objectives depending on the situation. What I think is going to happen is they might make some further gains in the east, in the Donbass and Luhansk regions, and then probably that's about it. But the thing is, driving them out would mean that, in effect, they are the defenders with all the advantages thereof. And I think it's more likely that we're going to see a deadlock. And it's hard to predict the exact lines, battle lines, but nonetheless, a deadlock in which two pretty exhausted powers are slugging it out like sort of boxers in the ring who've been in there for way too long. At one point, one of them will gather the resources for an offensive and perhaps make some advances before that peters out. Then maybe the other side will do the same. It's not a pretty thought. It's not at all heroic. But nonetheless, I think that looks at the moment the most likely thing. It's clear that there's no real talk of a peace deal at the moment. I think in part because both Bucha and Mariupol in different ways have made that impossible. But I think the final point I'd make, though, is that look, all wars are ultimately political acts, and so they depend on the political context. And therefore, I think the outcome will obviously depend on the Russian leadership, its changing sense of cost-benefit analysis, its decisions about whether it's willing to escalate, whether Putin is actually willing to call this a war and mobilize more widely, or, God forbid, thinks of something like using tactical nuclear weapons, but also the West's determination and capacity to continue to support Ukraine. So at the moment, unfortunately, I just think this is just going to be dragging on, but there are all kind of contingent factors.
Right, absolutely. One thing you mentioned, this statement by a Russian general, I guess it was on Friday, I believe, you know, suggesting quite strongly that Russia would aim to take the, you know, a swath of southern Ukraine, you know, leading from the Donbass and from the Russian border across, you know, where the isthmus connects mainland Ukraine to Crimea, and then through Odessa and to Moldova. But I think you said this looks like more like kind of a scare tactic, or, you know, a faint bluff or something. I guess I'd ask the question, and I guess the general who made this remark wasn't very high level. I mean, it wasn't Shoigu or a leader of the Russian military. I guess one question would be, is this the kind of thing where if a Russian official says this, or a military official, is that going to create expectations in Russia that this is what's going to happen? And does that make it harder for Putin to settle for something less?
To be perfectly honest, I get the sense, just from my own reading of the Russian media, that this was given a lot more coverage in the West than in Russia itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, the general, I mean, he's a major general, as I said, he was the Dvornikov's deputy at the Southern Military District, and now he's acting head. He's not insignificant, but no, I mean, this is not some grand political statement that I think will in any way compel the Kremlin. If it had been Putin, if it, as you say, if it had been Shoigu or someone similar, or if it had been given particularly high-level coverage within the Russian media, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But as is, no, I mean, I think this is just a statement, which is said, I mean, at best, I think is some kind of, as you say, a bluff. And at worst, it's just some general speaking off the hip. You know, off from the hip. I mean, it's worth noting also, I mean, he hedged it round in all kinds of conditionalities. He didn't simply say, this is our goal. He said that, you know, we would we want to reach out to Transnistria and so forth. I mean, it's framed in quite ambiguous ways.
Right. And I guess another question to follow up would be, you mentioned, you know, the idea of if a win for Ukraine includes, taking back Crimea. And I guess, and you said if things go beyond kind of a stalemate along somewhere in the Donbass, then it would be Russia that's on the defensive with all the advantages. Did you mean like military advantages or kind of political or?
Oh, military. I mean, it's a straightforward, right. I mean, again, it's not actually as if everything works out as an algorithm, but the general rule of thumb is that the attacker needs a 3-to-1 military advantage. If the Russians are properly dug in, they would have, you know, again, particularly in the Donbass, relatively short supply lines into Russia. They can be covered by Russia-based air power much more easily, that kind of thing. It just it's a lot harder to push them out once they're embedded there.
Right, and I guess Crimea, you know, would be another kind of issue altogether as well, which might even be more difficult, for Ukraine to take if it came to that.
The scenario in which Ukraine could take Crimea, I think, is not one really I can envisage at the moment, not least because for Moscow, look, being pushed out of the Donbass would be a catastrophic political blow to Putin and the Kremlin. But on the other hand, it is not existential for the Russian state. Like it or not, not just the Kremlin, but I think most Russians do regard Crimea as part of the Russian Federation. And therefore, an attack on that will be considered to be, shall we say, a sort of an invasion of the Russian mainland. And that is the kind of thing of which, for example, mass mobilizations could be sort of based. So, no, I mean, I think, you know, realistically, Crimea is too hard a target. If there's going to be movement, it's not going to be driven by direct military action. It will be because as a part of some potential future peace deal that finally resolves the Russian-Ukrainian relationship. And that is, I would have thought, years in the future.
Right. Okay. Thanks for that. It's very, very enlightening. I guess the second question I want to ask is more about what's happening in the Russian elites, as they call them. In particular, there's a Bloomberg News article that came out late last week, citing 10 people, it said, had direct knowledge of the situation. Bloomberg reported that, quote, with military losses mounting and Russia facing unprecedented international isolation, a small but growing number of senior Kremlin insiders are quietly questioning, unquote, Putin's decision to launch the invasion. Now, the article said that these people have come to believe that Putin's commitment to continuing the invasion will doom Russia 2 years of isolation and heightened tension that will leave its economy crippled, its security compromised, and its global influence gutted. At the same time, though, it said that the, quote, ranks of the critics at the pinnacle of power remain limited, spread across high-level posts in government and state-run business, and that Putin is determined to push on with the fight. Now, Mark, you mentioned on Twitter that you're hearing similar things from your contacts and sources in Russia, and that it's not just people in government and business. You wrote, quote, even within the security structures, there's growing alarm and dismay at the invasion, the way it was mishandled, and Putin's apparent refusal to appreciate the long-term dangers. Now, could you just tell us a little more about this growing concern and maybe about how it might affect developments in the coming weeks and months, I guess, in the war and in Russia itself?
Surely. I mean, let's be honest, those critics are absolutely right. I mean, in many ways, I think my view is that Putin is dragging Russia back to the 1970s, an authoritarian, an increasingly gerontocratic regime with a decaying, grinding to a halt economy, a population who are unenthused, to say the least, but having to be kept in line by propaganda and repression, and not much soft power or status in the world beyond that. But in terms of what that means in terms of the elite, we've got to start from the point that there are no Putinists. There is no real kind of ideology of Putinism. People are not there because I think of some kind of commitment to him. No one within the elite is going to hurl themselves on a grenade to protect the great leader. This is a system that worked precisely, so long as it did work, by elevating, motivating, and co-opting a collection of, on the whole, smart, ruthless, pragmatic, kleptocratic opportunists, for whom cooperating with the regime was the best route to fame and fortune. Now, of course, you know, for many of them, they're still living jolly good lives. But nonetheless, you know, there is a clear awareness of a whole variety of long-term risks, which means that they are going to be constantly making the kind of risk-benefit assessments. Now, as I'll come onto in a moment, at present, the risks in doing anything about this vastly outweigh the risks in just seeing what happens. But nonetheless, it means that there is always that potential. But when we talk about kind of elite criticism, we have a tendency, quite naturally, to focus on the technocrats, the relatively, in the context of this system, liberal figures. You know, we're talking about people like central bank chair Nabiullina, mayor of Moscow Sobyanin, who recently warned about the risk of even Moscow having 200,000 unemployed at this rate. Prime Minister Mishustin, even, who, you know, clearly he's not in any way openly saying anything against the war. But there have been just some suggestions that sort of people, you know, use a classic formulation, people close to Mishustin suggesting that he's unhappy. And likewise, Kirienko, the first deputy head of the political presidential administration and a sort of the political technologist in chief. I mean, he recently visited the Donbass. But again, from his point of view, as with all of them, this war makes their jobs immeasurably harder and also goes against their own vision of the Russia of the future. So, of course, they're going to be unhappy. Of course, also, the power that they have is very, very limited. They are the below stairs. They are the staff. They are the engine room technicians, if I can mix my metaphors, of the ship of state. You know, Putin expects them to keep things running one way or the other. And at the moment, they're doing their best. And interestingly, they clearly also have the authority to be able to maintain, you know, a relatively economically liberal model, if not politically liberal. Recently, for example, the draft of a new law on what to do about businesses that have left the Russian market came to the State Duma, sponsored by United Russia parliamentarians, though largely, it seems, drafted by the Ministry of Economic Development. And it's actually quite a liberal, practical document. Early talk about nationalizations and so forth has largely been put to one side. So, you know, the technocrats are unhappy. They have good reason to be unhappy, but there's just not a lot they can do about it except just simply try and sort of moderate within their own spaces. What we have a tendency, I think, to overlook, and in part because they're much less West-friendly in every sense of the word, is Putin's other flank, which is the nationalist flank. And I think what I think is particularly interesting, and if this really does emerge properly, I would suggest this is going to be much, much more dangerous for the regime, is precisely a pragmatic nationalist critique. People who, and these are often going to be within the security systems or the military, people who don't have a problem with forcibly making Ukraine realize that its proper place in the world is as part of Russia's sphere of influence, who don't have a problem with war as an instrument of statecraft, but they have a problem about it being handled so very, very badly. So this is actually much more, it's a competence based critique of Putin. And it's interesting because we've seen this. I mean, there were figures like, you know, Sterokov, Mr. Girkin, a man who sort of, by his own admission, pulled the trigger on the Donbass war, who's been a kind of critic for some time. We have all kinds of others who, you know, up to now have been very much in the political fringes, but who are now basically actually increasingly, I think it's fair to say, emboldened in how they criticise the Kremlin, how they criticise Shoigu, how they bring up the issues of corruption, which we've noted, which is clearly has been a real force undermining Russia's combat effectiveness. And they all put it down to Strelkov. I mean, he uses the term Russia's unique strategic advantage, in other words, Putin, as the real force. So I think, you know, this is what we have to bear in mind, that there are people who are more obviously and understandably critical, but who frankly don't have really much muscle in this system. And then there are people who are beginning to emerge with a different type of critique, but particularly they are within the structures that do have muscle within the system. Now, all that said, there's a lot of very kind of loose talk about the possibility of palace coups and such like. This is a system which is well designed to proof itself against coups. Mm-hmm. I think we're a long way from that. But one can think of a critical path. You've got, at the moment, the Rosgvardia, who are ultimately the first line of defence of the regime against the public, being chewed away in Ukraine and being very, very unhappy about how, as they see it, being used as cannon fodder. It's a very stupid move, frankly, to send your Praetorian Guard into battle like this. The deputy head of the Rosgvardia has been arrested and is now in Lefortovo prison. And when Zolotov, his boss, tried to get a meeting with Putin, apparently Putin ducked it. Meanwhile, the FSB, you've got one of the deputy heads, Beseda, also in Lefortovo prison. And look, you know, I'm sure all the things he's accused of doing, I'm sure he did. But on the principle, so does everyone else in the system. And so he's clearly being used as a scapegoat. We have growing disaffection within the military, and particularly if we see continued political interference. If, for example, Putin pushes Dvornikov to a major offensive earlier than really he will be ready for, simply because Putin wants a victory to declare on Victory Day, 9th of May, you know, all of these things could kind of add up and create what we might think of as potential resistance to Putin that is waiting for something to cohere it. Because, I mean, everyone is being very paranoid because this is a system that relies on paranoia and on atomizing people. Everyone, I mean, I'm sure everyone who of the sort of anti-Putinish sort of official camp would be fine with the old man going, but would prefer someone else do it. No one wants to start those conversations. But it means that you might say if something happens, if there's some black swan event, if there is a particular economic or political crisis, that's the point when this issue of the constant reassessment of loyalties comes in. And as we've seen, for example, you know, through the Warsaw Pact countries in 1989 and then to a degree also in the Soviet Union in 1991, you can have systems that look very solid, ruthless and in control of their elites and their public alike until all of a sudden they're not.
Yeah, absolutely. Very fascinating and, you know, insights that I really wouldn't have thought of myself in some ways. I just wanted to go back. For me, you cut out for just a few seconds. I don't know about for others, but when you were saying, you know, the second group, not the technocrats, but the mm-hmm. second group, you know, they're fine. They're not, don't have a problem with war. They don't have a problem with forcing Ukraine to be subjugated, I guess. But they do have a problem, and I guess you said something like with failure or, you know.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, yeah. They have a problem with it being done badly, and particularly they have a problem with it. I mean, again, everyone will blame other people. You know, the generals will think that Putin relied too much on the spooks. The spooks will probably think that Putin didn't have the generals properly in hand, and everyone will complain about everyone else's corruption.
Right. So I guess, I mean, sort of two possible scenarios, just kind of trying to synthesize both questions or both conversations we've had. if things kind of move along, drag along, and there's kind of a stalemate in the Donbass or in eastern Ukraine for a long time, I guess maybe it's not so likely that some like a black swan event, I guess you said, will happen and the things will change quickly. But then on the other hand, everything's pretty unpredictable.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think this system can survive. I mean, you know, whether we talk about it as going to be in the 1970s, Soviet Union, or even worst example, sort of North Koreanization, you know, one way or the other, it will adapt. Economic sanctions are not going to bring it down, in my opinion. They absolutely bite dramatically, and particularly into the regime's capacity to renovate its military forces, maintain the same level of adventurism abroad. I mean, I think with the exception of Syria, which I think they're definitely going to try and keep going as much as they can, I imagine that we're going to see, you know, all the various hotspots that we worried about, like Mali and so forth, there's not going to be any kind of resources being able to be put into there. But generally speaking, I mean, if this system has to militarize and mobilize and basically become a state-controlled one, if need be, it will. And it's interesting that, for example, you know, Alexei Kudrin, former finance minister, economic liberal, certainly, you know, talking about 2 to 3 year adaptation process. And I think that's the kind of time frame people are thinking of. You know, obviously, the military's capacities to fight are going to be very, very different in a year's time, given that it can't kind of replenish the precision-guided munitions to anything like the same level and that kind of thing. You know, but nonetheless, I think we have to accept that potentially we are seeing a status quo that will survive long-term. But exactly, it becomes unpredictable. It may look strong, but it will be brittle. Its capacity to adapt to changes, which could be anything from, you know, an unusually harsh winter to a cascading economic crisis that leads to very high levels of unemployment. I mean, there are suggestions of 12 to 13% unemployment, which would be catastrophic, mm-hmm. You know, in these circumstances. Or, of course, something happening to the Vojt himself. You know, in any of these cases, it's a lot harder to predict what would happen.
Right, absolutely. We're running out of time, and we'll have to wrap it up shortly, but I'd like to take a few questions. So there is at least one question out there now, and I'll read it from Stephanie Carvin. And it has to do with the corruption that you mentioned, and also the sanctions and how they're hitting. The question is there any indication of how sanctions have affected Russian organized crime? Does it create more opportunities, or is it financial hurt for them, or both for organized crime groups?
I mean, obviously, sanctions do create opportunities, and a lot of that will be relatively petty. Excuse me. Making sure that, you know, the mistresses of oligarchs get their Chanel handbags or whatever. Sorry. In the longer term, my suspicion is that we'll see the state try to use it more.
Okay.
Tail end of a cold. And again, going back to this North Korean model, North Korea has Bureau 39, which is essentially the state's Ministry of Crime. It's, you know, it uses organized crime to break sanctions in so many different ways, bringing in technologies, hacking to gain foreign currency, printing counterfeit banknotes, producing methamphetamines or for export, that kind of thing. My suspicion is that what we might find is organized crime increasingly becoming nationalized, again, if this lasts long, as part of the sort of the normalization of a sanctions era, is actually what the state will do is whether it actually kind of just simply provides scope for gangsters to do things that are useful to the state, or whether it actually basically takes them over and says, look, like it or not, you now work for the government. But I think we will see existing ad hoc connections between the Russian state and Russian organized crime increasingly mobilized and institutionalized. So I think, you know, for a lot of gangs at the moment, things are hard because getting things across the border is hard. I mean, obviously, it's at the moment with the war, the existing flows of illegal commodities, above all Afghan heroin, through Russia, through Ukraine into Europe, that's all been thrown up in the air. So there's a lot of adaptation going on. But my big concern is precisely for a new Kremlin Bureau 39.
Well, that's definitely very fascinating and informative. Okay, thanks, Mark, for that answer. Any other questions from the audience? Give it a few moments here. Anyone has any?
Come now, don't be shy, people.
Hello, do you hear me well?
Yes, we do.
Yes.
My name is Maria and I'm from Ukraine. I'm grateful for this space. Thank you for covering the situation from geopolitical perspective. I just want to probably add some glimpse from the human rights perspective. I think it is very important also to talk about those people in Ukraine, active community leaders, journalists, human rights activists, former veterans, educators who are now being abducted in the temporarily taken territories by Russian law enforcement and Russian forces. And it's not a question, it's just a kind of request. If you have some moment, just take your time and do some post with hashtag #TheTaken for all those Ukrainians. There are now about 150 fully proved cases of abductions and enforced disappearances, and we believe that there are much more. So if you tweet with hashtag #TheTaken, on the people who are now, you know, struggling for Ukraine because they were vocal that all these territories, like in Kherson, Zaporizhia, etc., is Ukraine. And we Ukrainians ask you to do this because once the names of abductees are known in the world, there is a great chance to survive tortures, for example, not to be exposed to tortures. So, for your efforts, thank you.
All right, thanks for that. Maria, I'll just mention we RFERL has been doing reporting on that issue. I mean, obviously, you know, sometimes when we talk about the war, as you said, from a geopolitical perspective, you know, some of the things happening, which I tried to mention at the start of this podcast, you know, don't come to the forefront. But, you know, obviously that's sort of the main effect of this war is just the human catastrophe. So it's a good thing to keep in mind. And RFERL has been doing reporting on this situation, people being abducted and disappearing, particularly in southern Ukraine and parts of Ukraine that are now held by Russia. We've had reports from Kherson and I believe a couple other places about that. So we are trying, you know, in our way to get the information about that out to the public, to the world. Any other questions? just give it a few more moments again. Okay. So here's another question through the moderator, a question for Mark. Is there anything that the West can offer Putin to help him climb down, like an off-ramp, I guess has been the word that people have been using, other than simply securing outright victory? Is this a war that he can't lose in terms of he can't lose for his own purposes?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it's very different. Well, look, I mean, unless we're willing to throw Ukraine under the bus, which I don't believe we are, and certainly do not believe that we should, I don't believe there is at the moment anything that can be done. I think that, in fact, he needs really to be forced to appreciate that there is no positive scenario. You know, that actually, I think there, you know, there may well be still that notion that, well, things didn't go well before, but, you know, I don't know, the military will be able to encircle the joint forces operation troops in the Donbass and in the process deliver a convincing military blow to the Ukrainians or whatever else. I think in a way he will have to be in a different headspace before he can be induced to withdraw. So I think at the moment, unfortunately, actually, all we can do to try and sort of maintain peace is doing as we are at the moment, which is supporting the Ukrainians with what they need and maintaining the economic pressure on Russia. However, in terms of, you know, thinking of slightly more positive things, I mean, I think that in some ways there's some things that we should just maybe sort of be more cautious about our rhetoric. You know, if we are honestly saying that we will not be satisfied until Vladimir Putin is standing in front of a, you know, a court in The Hague, and not just him, but basically people from throughout the whole military structure, if we are saying that we will not be satisfied until basically his regime is humbled, that's an entirely understandable perspective, moral perspective. But what it also does is it creates a situation where he has no alternatives between escalation and total surrender. He will not surrender. And therefore, in that case, we are basically, you know, mandating escalation. So, I mean, I think that for now, there's not much that can be done. As and when we get any kind of hint that the Russians are willing to deal properly, then, I mean, then we have to make it clear that obviously there will be no forgive and forget. We will never be returning to the status quo of 2.5 months ago. And probably, I think, so long as Putin is in the Kremlin, which probably means so long as Putin is alive, that there will continue to be certain sanctions on Russia, that the relationship will be, again, going back to that sort of metaphor I used before, akin to 1970s Cold War, in that there is kind of pragmatic interaction on issues of common interest, but otherwise that essentially the West and Russia consider themselves to be in a state of conflict. But that nonetheless, you know, we, in some ways, that we can deal with that, and that we can foresee a future in which actually there will be certain sanctions relief for Russia, etc., so long as it pulls all its troops out of Ukraine and acknowledges that Ukraine is a sovereign nation that gets to determine its own fate. The only wiggle room is Crimea. Now, I fully appreciate, in terms of international law and so forth, Crimea is not Russian. However, we also have to acknowledge that I think it's probably true to say that in 2014, and quite possibly still today, a majority of people, Crimea probably, you know, even if it had been an entirely honest, legitimate vote, would have voted in favour of being part of Russia. There are ways round it. There are, you know, ways which we could say, well, okay, there, you know, there will be another vote on the future that will be done under proper international supervision. But in some ways, I think that if we are also going to basically demand that Crimea must be returned, then again, I think that probably is a deal breaker. None of this is right. None of this is good. But if otherwise we run into a situation where basically we are locking everyone, and particularly the Ukrainians, into an eternal and debilitating conflict. But I mean, beyond that, I think that the time for off ramps is not now. I think actually Russia needs to be demonstrated that it will not win. Last point, it suddenly occurred to me. When Gorbachev wanted to pull Soviet forces out of Afghanistan, he appreciated that it was politically problematic, and therefore, at first, he had to give the generals free rein. He had to say, well, basically, fine, you think you can win this? You have a go at winning it. And it was only when they had demonstrably failed that he could then politically sort of actually turn to them and say, well, okay, now we'll do it my way, and we'll start the withdrawal process. Now, Putin is as far from Gorbachev as anyone could imagine. But the point is, in a way, it is likewise a case that in some ways Putin is like the generals. He will have to realize that he is failing militarily before any kind of peace is likely to be achievable.
All right. I think that's a very interesting historical parallel is a great place to end this. So I'm going to wrap it up. Mark, thanks very much for joining me. That's amazing insights again, and I hope to talk to you again next month.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure.
All right. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. Thanks for listening.